Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 132 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, non-fiction writer John Kay explains why writing a foreign nation's history is no more presumptuous than writing about Picts or Scots, and shares his enthusiasm for R.H. Tawney, a man who was more history writer than historian. Following John, Tobias Jones considers, as both reader and writer, the fascination of the true crime genre and the profound truths with which it can connect us. First up, here's John Kay with History is Other People.
In a broadside aimed at Western civilization, M.K. Gandhi once likened the mother of parliaments to a prostitute and dismissed hospitals as institutions for propagating sin. According to Gandhi, parliament's only function was to gratify the whims of the prime minister and hospitals by treating substance abusers and alcoholics simply encouraged others to behave irresponsibly. The Mahatma got away with such provocative statements because the tone of his critique was unfailingly reasoned and polite. Even if he thought him balmy, it seemed ungrateful to say so. Mostly, he targeted systems and institutions rather than those responsible for them. For his British adversaries, he often evinced a genuine regard. In Hind Swaraj, a Q&A on Indian self-rule from which these nuggets of negativity are extracted, only one specifically British trait is singled out. Bizarrely, it is the British's, or rather the Englishman's, proprietary attitude to history. "The English have a habit of writing history," says Gandhi. "They pretend to study the manners and customs of all peoples. God has given us a limited mental capacity, but they usurp the function of the Godhead and indulge in novel experiments. They write about their own researches in the most laudatory terms and hypnotise us into believing them. We, in our ignorance, then fall at their feet." But whoa up there, I mean, hang on, that's a bit close to the bone. Writing other people's history is what I've been doing for most of my writing life. It's a passion, an indulgence, and nearly a living. It's not a habit, and exploring Asian history is no more presumptuous than writing about Picts and Scots. "The past is a foreign country," says the narrator in L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between. "They do things differently there, just as they do on the other side of the world. Like hell, history is always other people. We trespass when we cross the centuries, just as we do when we cross the continents. Or as Gandhi would have it, we usurp the function of the Godhead, whether grappling with the Middle Kingdom or the Middle Ages." I doubt, then, if my rendering of China's history would be any more credible, let alone hypnotic, if I were Chinese. It might help sales in China, but it would be no guarantee of impartiality. A Bengali postgraduate once challenged some particularly fatuous generalisation in my history of India. Red-faced and stalling frantically, I suggested she try writing a history of Scotland. It couldn't fail, I told her. Scottish readers would be flattered, they would value her detachment, and if howlers like mine went largely undetected, imagine what she could get away with. So writing history should not be left exclusively to those whose antecedents played a part in it. I'm not even sure it should be left to historians. The giants at whose feet Gandhi supposed his countrymen falling in adulation were men like Gibbon, Carlyle, Macaulay, and James Mill. Mill had published a massive history of India without ever feeling the need to go there, and Macaulay, without learning a single Oriental language, had famously dismissed the whole corpus of Indian and Arabic literature as less valuable than a single shelf of a good European library. No wonder Gandhi was disgusted. But note that none of these 19th century luminaries would pass for historians today. Gibbon, Carlyle, and Macaulay didn't teach. They didn't specialise, they didn't pride themselves on using unpublished sources, and they didn't let conflicting evidence come in the way of a cherished conviction or a fine turn of phrase. They were first and foremost writers, men of letters and of public affairs. I suppose we'd now call them public intellectuals. Gandhi had got me thinking. Who is best qualified to write history? And why so much of the best history written by non-historians? Last century's giants might find today's senior common rooms just as uncongenial as Macaulay and co. Churchill's confident prose would be shot down in flames. Hugh Trevor Roper would face a peer review firing squad for authenticating those spurious Hitler diaries. And R.H. Tawney, my model, and the one history-writing Englishman Gandhi might have endorsed, would be best remembered for having been left for dead on the battlefield. As a sergeant in the 22nd Manchester Regiment, on the 1st of July 1916, the 35-year-old Richard Henry Tawney had been one of the first over the top in the Battle of the Somme. He was promptly hit in the chest and abdomen by machine gun fire, then half buried by an exploding shell. More dead than alive, he lay unattended in no man's land for a day and a half before being retrieved and invalided home. He played no further part in the war. But Tawney's experience of serving in the ranks, he'd refused a commission on principle, and his near miraculous survival are supposed to have been influential in moulding his career. As a committed socialist and a staunch Christian, he espoused social reform, promoted adult education, and provided the young Labour Party with a sound basis of political theory. He also became an historian, and construing history as morality, an historian with a mission: to arm the working man with an intellectual understanding of his disadvantaged condition. He lectured to mining communities and factory workers in the industrial towns of the Midlands and the North. On the shop floor, he learnt while he taught, and these insights into inequality and injustice informed his two great historical studies. One dealt with the commercialisation of agriculture and land ownership as a result of the enclosures. The other blamed the acquisitive and individualistic ethos of capitalism on the Reformation and the displacement of Christian values. It also sold an astonishing 150,000 copies. Economic data, where available, lent support to his hypotheses. He founded the Economic History Review and from 1931 held a professorship at the London School of Economics. But this is all a little misleading. Lawrence Goldman, Tawney's biographer, proposes that the turning point in his career may not, in fact, have been on the Somme, but on the Isis. At Balliol, he had read classics in the near certainty of getting a first. It didn't materialise. He got an unexciting second. His father fulminated, his college sympathised. If Tawney himself was devastated, it was mainly on their account. Having myself got an even more dismal degree, I know how he felt. The expectations of others prove harder to handle than one's own. Instead of Oxford, classics, and a comfortable life educating the elite, Tawney chose history, socialism, and enlightening the working classes. Years later, he took revenge on Oxford when, as an examiner, he doled out firsts with mischievous abandon. But then Tawney was as ill-suited to 20th century academia as Macaulay or Gibbon. According to Goldman, he never had any sort of training in English history, and the evidence to support his theories often proved embarrassingly elusive. Other historians might, in his own words, make a darkness and call it research. He preferred interrogating the past in the light of general ideas. He focused on societies rather than individuals, and trends rather than events. Whether Gandhi ever read Tawney, I don't know. He should have. Tawney's genial tone, his saintly reputation, and his concern for the underprivileged would have resonated with the Mahatma. So would the discovery that Tawney's father had taught Sanskrit in Calcutta, and Tawney himself had been born there. In later life, swathed in tweed, with a kindly smile, a drooping moustache, and a pipe that once ignited spontaneously in the middle of a lecture, Tawney looked every crumpled inch the eccentric English academic. Yet his interests were far from parochial, and though he never re-embarked for India, he did tackle China. From the floor at the LSE, he once protested against the archive-led nature of historical research. "What the historian needs is not more documents, but stronger boots," he announced. The boots would have been handy when he left for Shanghai in 1930. He'd been commissioned to report on agricultural reform in China's more famine-prone provinces. Perhaps someone thought Republican China's agrarian problems mirrored those of Tudor England, and perhaps Tawney thought a remote arena should be no more challenging than a remote era. He was away for a year, travelling and interviewing, and he came back with a book. Entitled Land and Labour in China, it scarcely sets the pulse racing. Dependent on interpreters and translators, Tawney often appears ill-informed or out of his depth. Getting things spectacularly wrong proves to be an occupational hazard. He likes the people and admires their industry, but sees no chance of anything being made of China for a few hundred years. He thinks the Japanese invasion of Manchuria will stop there. It didn't. And that communism will never catch on. It did. He admits he may be wrong, but perseveres regardless. The result reveals more about China than any contemporary study and is recognised as what Goldman calls a minor classic. Like Gibbon and Macaulay, Tawney is read today, if at all, as much for his writing as his history. It's not to everyone's taste. Capacious sentences are braced with metaphor and studied with punctuation in an effort to contain their dependent clauses. They may require more than one reading. And the majesty of the prose, by lending a gloss of conviction to the content, might make today's historians deeply suspicious. But what Tawney, and all great history writers, manages is to make his work memorable. Cars, roads, electricity, artificial fertilizers. In 1930s China, he finds few of what he calls these pertinent amenities. On the contrary, loom, lathe and kiln have scarcely been altered throughout ascertainable history. Likewise, the institutions of family, marriage and property, the relationships of landlord and tenant, master and apprentice, debtor and creditor. "What elsewhere is forgotten is in China remembered," he writes. "And what elsewhere is a memory is in China a fact. The labour required to build the Great Wall is still resented. The humiliation heaped on China by the Western powers will never be forgiven." As someone who once boated up the Mekong by way of research into the origins of French colonial rule in Indochina, I find his booted approach to China rather encouraging. Tawney listens and observes, struggles to comprehend and speculates with caution. Not unlike Gandhi himself, he respects honest toil and identifies with the underdog. Seldom does he speak of his documentational researches, and never in laudatory terms. He recognises that all history is the history of other peoples. He trusts to his general ideas more than to the archivist's catalogues. He accepts that he may get things wrong, and he takes immense care with the writing. Like Macaulay and co., he's more history writer than historian, and to my mind, all the more readable for it.
That was John Kay, recorded by James McConachy. You can find out more about John on his website at www.johnkay.com. That's Kay spelled K-E-A-Y. Next, here's Tobias Jones with True Crime.
The amused disdain of friends and peers for my preferred literary genre has been a constant over the years. They often look surprised when I admit that what I really love is true crime. It's a bit like someone confessing in a conversation amongst classical musicians that they love Chaz and Dave. No one knows whether it's a wind-up or whether my taste is truly so dodgy that I'm serious. "Really?" they ask, as if my taste is insufferably lowbrow. Because for most people, true crime is only one rung above Mills and Boone, and probably only two above the soft porn of 50 Shades and all that. In an attempt to justify my taste for true crime, I've begun to wonder why it is that I'm so drawn to it. I am, I've realised, far more fixated by the first than the second word of the genre. It's the truth more than the crime that I find captivating. I relish reading crime fiction, Ross Macdonald, the contemporary rival of Chandler, especially. But underneath it all, crime fiction is still just the spinning of a made-up story. It's the brutal reality of an actual murder which lends it a solidity and seriousness. So what you read is not just a yarn or a page-turner. It is about real life and real death. In a world which is ever more virtual, removed, fictionalised and mediated, the presence of a corpse gives the text a gravitas you hardly find anywhere else. It's immediate and undeniable. Perhaps that's why I prefer going to funerals than weddings. There's a terrible absoluteness and finality instead of future gazing and mawkish hope. Although I love nuance and subtlety, I also long for some certainty in life. And if death and taxes are the only ones we've got, I know which of the two makes better reading. Murder is a very particular type of death, of course, and I confess that I am drawn to the darkness of assassination. I'm fascinated by the heights and depths to which humanity can travel, by the atrocities as well as the wonders. To ignore the grimmest aspects of human nature seems to me to see and analyse only a part of the spectrum, to be almost myopic about immorality. I want to see it all, however gruesome, because actually that darkness is like a furnace that refines us, that somehow makes us understand ourselves. As Pablo Neruda once said, "From each crime are born bullets that will one day seek out in you where the heart lies." That, perhaps, makes my interest appear more high-minded than it really is. If I'm honest, I'm also drawn to true crime because I relish the frisson and the goosebumps. I don't mean that I like the blood and gore. I'm actually very squeamish. And I'm not attracted to the dark side in any sort of sinister way, I'm sure of that. But I do find reading about murder hypnotic and mesmerising. I even find it relaxing, which might sound bizarre. I often watch a war film or gangster movie before falling asleep. I'm obviously not alone in this. Why else would the bean counters of the creative industry say, ironically, that crime pays, or more brutally, that there's no business like show a business? But the attraction of true crime is partly because I'm working on foreign soil. Since Italy is my professional turf, murder is a way to see, study and analyse that nation. It's the keyhole through which I peer into the secrets of the land, with all its corruption and organised crime. Virgil wrote, "From a single crime know the nation," and I certainly believe that specific murders are mirrors, albeit distorted, which reflect the countries in which they occur. The crimes of Charles Manson say something very eloquent about the underbelly of 1960s America. In the same way, the murder of Roberto Calvi, presumably by Cosa Nostra in 1982, was a prism which laid out the darkest corners of Italy's First Republic. Much of the most forensic travel writing I know comes through the examination of iconic crimes. John Leake's The Vienna Woods Killer, about a serial killer in Austria. Or Gordon Burns's Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son, about the Yorkshire Ripper. Or John Berendt's Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, set in the American Deep South. In The Art of the Novel, E.M. Forster wrote that story as such can only have one merit, that of making the audience want to know what happens next. And conversely, it can only have one fault, that of making the audience not want to know what happens next. Judged by that yardstick, true crime gets the highest merit marks. It's a genre with a natural narrative drive. You long to get back to it to discover what's going to happen. Even in an 800-page book like The Executioner's Song, Norman Mailer's magisterial dissection of an underclass chancer, there's an astonishing paciness. You're pulled along like no other genre. Once you've been through the white waters of a true crime book, much other non-fiction seems like a placid pond. There's often not much current or flow, and not always any eagerness to come back to it. The other aspect of true crime which fascinates me is the study of character. Character is, as every writer knows, the foundation stone of any successful book. Crime writing is unique in its ability to twist the kaleidoscope of character, suddenly revealing a person to be completely different. To have a character throughout your book who the reader knows but doesn't know is an extraordinarily hard thing to pull off. But that is the appeal of the classic Agatha Christie-like denouement in which Marple or Poirot point the finger. You see a character in a completely different but completely convincing light. Ross MacDonald spoke of this reveal as needing to create tragic vibrations which run backward through the entire structure, allowing you to read someone in a very different way. To achieve that in true crime is, I think, even harder than in fiction. You can't invent it. Your raw material is already there with all its lumps and bruises. You have to show a criminal as he or she appears to the world, and then, peeling off the mask like so many onion skins, to reveal them as they really are. It reflects what people are like in real life, multifaceted, contradictory, weird, confused, deceitful, even dangerous. A classic of the true crime genre, The Stranger Beside Me, does exactly that. For months, the author Anne Rule sat next to the softly spoken, good-looking Ted Bundy at a volunteer call centre. He was sensitive and good company. It was only slowly that she appreciated he was the serial rapist and killer for whom the whole of America's law enforcement community was hunting. It's that enormous discrepancy between man and mask which makes true crime so enthralling. It's also what makes it so challenging to write. In crime fiction, the murderer will often have a limp or a facial scar, wear a black overcoat, have a gold tooth or some similar cliché. Real life isn't like that. When I was writing Blood on the Altar, about an Italian serial killer, I was repeatedly frustrated by my inability to encapsulate the character of the creepy hair fetishist I had studied for years. The more I watched him, the less I was able to say about him. There was no man behind the mask. In People Who Eat Darkness, Richard Lloyd Parry's exemplary study of a Japanese serial killer, there's a similar conclusion. Trying to get to grips with the blank of the murderer, Lloyd Parry asks himself, what if there was no inside, but only what was visible? The shell, in other words, was all that was to be had of the nut. For a writer who relishes a challenge, this is the ultimate. To describe not something, but nothing. If serial killers are, thankfully, rare and extraordinary, their victims are invariably common and ordinary. True crime offers the grim satisfaction of glimpsing and immortalising in death the normal. G.K. Chesterton reckoned that the most extraordinary thing in the world is an ordinary man and an ordinary woman and their ordinary children. But we never hear about the ordinary because it isn't newsworthy until something unusual happens to that ordinariness. It's that juxtaposition of normal and abnormal which gives true crime its claim to greatness. It rescues victims not from death, but from obscurity. It makes the common somehow noble by describing the preciousness and precariousness of an ordinary existence. It also makes heroes out of the commoners left behind, the bereaved parents, siblings and children. As well as seeing the worst of humanity, you see the best. In Joe McGinnis's sensational A Fatal Vision, or Paul French's Midnight in Peking, the figures of the grieving but dogged fathers fighting for justice and truth, as in the older stories, are both harrowing and heroic. That's why true crime not only, I admit it, entertains, it also cautions us that there, but for the grace of God, go you or I. It reveals what we're all capable of, both the heroic and the horrific. Like all great art, true crime tells us something profound about humanity. And it makes life richer by showing how fleeting life can be.
That was Tobias Jones, recorded by James McConaghy. You can find out more about Tobias on his website at www.tobias-jones.co.uk. And that concludes episode 132, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 133, novelist Kerry Young speaks with Frances Burns about how her early life in Jamaica influenced her novels, including her father's gangster life in Kingston and her mother's Catholicism and ideas of redemption. Kerry also speaks about her passionate feelings about being Chinese Jamaican. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.